Welcome everyone to What the Bark, the Right Paw podcast. We're back again for episode 4 and we're joined today by a very exciting guest. We're excited to have our first breeder on the podcast and alongside obviously George, we've got the fantastic Di Gooding from Wrinkles, Chows and Sharpeys joining us this week. Welcome Di.
Hey Nathan, thanks for having me.
Hey Di, yes Nathan, who thought we'd last 4 episodes? We have, and as we discussed in our first episode, we were going to get guests on board, and Di, you're our first guest.
George, that's pretty exciting.
When we're cutting that ribbon,
yep,
in 2 years' time, we'll have you there. You can be the honorary first guest on What the Bark, the Right Paw podcast.
That's really exciting, and I'm really looking forward to that.
And we always start by sort of acknowledging just how we look. And Di, like always, your hair, the colour in your hair. You've still continued to look. Every time I see you've got some colour. What is it? Is it a purple I see there?
Or? Yeah, a bit of a purple rip.
Purpley pink tinge.
A bit of a nod to my age, is it? Yeah.
I love it. When we first met Di, she sported that same sort of, fiery pink hairdo, which is just so distinctive. I love it.
And I must say, Di, I've met you, what was it, about 3 or 4 years ago. You ran those Chow webinars, seminars on health and breed down at, was that Buller, I believe?
Down at Buller with the Chow Chow Club of Victoria. That's right. That was awesome. Our Chow boot camp. We're due
camp. That was what it was called. And, you know, Nathan, you missed out because one of the great things about the boot camp is you walk into there and the food. I remember Di.
Oh, yes.
And I'm talking, you want junk food, you want quality food, it's there. It was just to die for.
Yeah, for those that know Mel
and dog food.
Williams will know about the food.
And you gave me my first coffee mug, the Chow Chow mug. I remember I got that as an honorary guest, and there was something else you gave out which still sits in my office.
But probably there was pens.
Pens, that's the one.
Yes.
But yeah, great way you run that, and it was fantastic, and all your members were there, from new to some that had been there for ages. So,
it's an awesome idea, and hats off to the Chow Chow Club of Victoria and their committee that they did that, and it's something, you know, we would love to see many other breed clubs do, you know. It would be really good idea.
No, well done, you do it well.
And Di also wasn't just our first sort of new guest on the podcast, but she was also the very first breeder on Right Paw as well. She was the first breeder on our site, but also the first one that gave us a fantastic introduction to the dog world back at the Royal Canberra Show a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we were lucky to have a couple of mutual friends and, you know, got introduced to each other, and I know a good idea when I see it. And I just thought, you know, I really liked the vision that Right Paw had and was more than happy to come on board and, take it up.
That's enough good stuff about Di. It's fine.
Oh, yeah, look, otherwise we're not going to get more guests on. We need to big the guests up a little bit.
Okay. Well, Di, it's going to go downhill from here.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But Di, for the listeners who don't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about how you first got into breeding as well.
Yeah, so Nathan, look, I've always had a passion for animals. I'd have to say, you know, one of my favourite photos looking through the family photo albums is me as a toddler sitting on a stool feeding a little orphaned lamb, you know, and I go back to that picture a lot. The grandies love that picture. What are you doing, Nana? And that passion just kept going through and through. My first job as a 10-year-old was looking after other people's dogs, you know, and they'd either bring them to my home or I'd go to their home and look after them. I don't see 10-year-olds these days doing that or being allowed to do that sort of thing. I think it was a bit of slave labour. But, you know, and from there, I spent many hours on a farm. We were lucky or fortunate enough to have good friends that had farms and spent many hours on the farm, you know, tying around the poor horses. When I think of some of those poor horses that had to put up with me. And it was through that farm life I was then introduced to a lovely lady named Rita Ogilvy, still a very good friend of my mother's. And she had a show dog, you know, and beautiful big Springer Spaniel. And I loved this dog. I couldn't have enough of this dog. And there's even a photo of me, you know, as a 15-year-old pretending to stack this dog and, you know, whatever. From there, I went off to an actual dog show. I had no idea what was going on. And to the credit
Di, you went to a dog show at the age of 15.
At the age of 15. It was in Narrabundah. It was in Canberra. It was in Narrabundah, down sort of near where the olive sort of farm is now and where the caravan park used to be. And, yeah, I went to this dog show, and there was a lady there that had Irish setters. And to her credit, she saw how keen and interested I was, and she let me have a turn. And I didn't turn back from there. So to all those people that do go to shows and see young people out there, you just never know. You know, if you were to give them a go, you never know, you'll end up with another Di Gooding. Might turn a few people away.
So good. You went the Springer, then the Irish.
And then the Irish Senate, yeah.
I wonder if, today when you go to the shows, do you think that would happen today? I'm just sort of putting it out there. Do you think, you'd be taken on board and dog shunned in being able to, tell me how it's changed when you...
Well, unfortunately now we have this thing called insurance and, duty of care and whatever. Because of insurance and duty of care, you can't let some kid wandering off the street and have a go. Having said that, with junior handlers and things do try and encourage people. But I it is something I find a little bit disappointing. It shows that people don't interact with the public as much as I would really like them to.
Yep.
Understanding, of course, that people, you get into a zone. I get into a zone at a dog show, when you're, a few classes ahead of yours and you're getting that last bit of pampering done and get that bit of fluff in the right spot and that, final little hair in the right spot. And the last thing you need is, a 15-year-old kid asking you questions. But, just being polite and asking them to come back soon would be great. But I think, it's something that the dog show world needs to look at is, how do we bring novices in, new people in? How do we try and get that 15-year-old Di Gooding back,
Yeah, and welcome more people into that world. It's fantastic. I didn't know that. So to you as a 15-year-old, what was that experience like? Like how did it go down?
It was just awesome. It was quite a young dog that I took around and made stand up. But just I felt so proud making this dog stand there and holding its tail out and, making sure its ears were in the right place and everything. And, I really liked that sense of accomplishment, being able to have a dog do what it should do and look as good as it did. Yeah.
I'm going to apologise. You can hear some dogs barking in the background, Di. They are my dogs. I'm actually at home, and because it's 1 o'clock, the posties just come. They're carrying on, and I can't stop them. You know what it's like. They're just
that's a classic example of how dogs learn. I use the postie explanation all the time of how dogs learn. That's their stimulus, their antecedent. Their barking is their behaviour. Their reward is that he drives away.
That's right.
Every day.
I can't stop them. They've come in here to look and think they've done a great job, wagging their tail, barking at the post to let me know. And, little do they know, I'm sort of trying to tell them, no, get back out there. I've got it now. They don't listen. But interesting, you mentioned dog show. I will say, when I go to dog shows, one thing I do enjoy is the chat socially. Everyone loves to talk to you. So, if there's a positive, when you say, people, it's changed a bit. If there's one thing that hasn't changed, everyone likes to talk about their breed, why they're into it, anything. So, and conversation is lovely at dog shows and still can. And that's one of the things that I do miss.
No, you're right. I mean, people do love to talk. As I said, sometimes they get in a zone and they get a little bit distracted and they may seem like they don't want anything to do with you. But you ask them a few questions about their breed and you're stuck, you're done. You'll be standing there for hours listening.
And you've titled a fair few dogs. I mean, obviously Chows and Sharpays now, but was it always Chows and Sharpays? Or where did you start?
So my very first show dog that I actually owned, so I left school at 18, went straight into the Defence Forces, and my very first pay packet, once I was sort of back into my first unit, my very first pay packet went to buying myself my Doberman. So Dobermans were my first love. I love the dogs. I love the look at them. So that was my very first breed. Had a lot of success with them, did some trialing as well as showing. and really enjoyed that. And my sister, who sort of was following along in my footsteps behind me, she had bull terriers. And so it was sort of a natural progression too that I had bull terriers that used to turn a few heads when I'd walk into a show, because this was the day before you had trolleys and trendy trailers and things like that. You'd turn up in your car and your dogs leap out of the car and, you know, all hell would break loose. And I'd walk into the show with a Doberman and a bull terrier in hand. And
it's quite a statement.
The crowds parted as you walked through, but beautiful dogs, you know, loved each other and, yeah, had a lot of fun with my bull terriers and my Dobermans. But then I had a bit of a break from showing. My children, God bless them, are very good at sport and they played a lot of representative sport. So my weekends were spent, in fact, my whole life was spent chasing my children around the countryside and, you know, even other countries playing sport. And that's so...
Can I ask you, what was the sport they represented?
So netball mostly for my daughter, a bit of cricket with my son, and he's also a gridiron player.
From fur babies to actual babies, the responsibilities had to shift.
We call them skin babies, fur babies and skin babies. Yeah. So he also played a bit of rugby, a bit of league too, you know, with school and that sort of thing. And he was a bit of an athlete too. So there was always something going on with the kids. So I just felt like I couldn't give the dogs, you know, the time and the commitment that it takes. I had stepped back for a good 15 years. And then once they sort of grew up and flew the coop and hubby was working weekends and I was bored and whatever. And I thought, you know what, I think I might go back into dog showing. And at the time we had a Shar Pei, a very old Shar Pei, living with us. He was left behind by my sister who moved to Queensland and couldn't take him with her at the time. And it was only supposed to be an interim thing. And 7 years later, I was sort of asking her when this interim thing, you know, finishes. But good old Simba stayed with us until his parting. And when I decided I would get back into showing, I thought, I think I like Shar Peis. I might have a little look. And there wasn't many around, but it just happened that there was a woman locally had a beautiful litter of Shar Peis, and she was happy to let me take one on, and that was that. We got bitten by the bug again. Hubby got bitten by the bug. Hilarious. And so it just went from there. And the transition from Shar Pei to Chow, or the inclusion of the Chows, came about. Dogs New South Wales did a article in their newsletter about the smooth coat chow, and I was like, I did not know they come in smooth, and I was hooked. Took me 4 years and 3 rough coat chows to finally get myself a smooth coat chow, but I have one now. But the relationship and the link in the ancestry of the two breeds,
Gone for two very ancient breeds there, yes, the Shar Pei and the Chow Chow. When you look at their origins, they are one of the most ancient breeds.
Yes.
And I've got a question, and I sort of, this was put to me by my son when I said I've got I'm meeting a Chow Chow breeder. Why two words? Why Chow Chow and not just Chow?
So nice they named it twice.
Yeah, so good it needed two names. I mean, I was born in Wagga Wagga, so it makes sense that I have a Chow Chow. So I really have no idea why. There's controversy over where the name even came from. Different ideas that it was, Chow was the name that they gave miscellaneous items in cargo, and the first Chows that came out from China were in the miscellaneous parts, so they were named Chow. There's other ideas that's got connections with some ancient language and that. So,
They were popular in the 80s. I remember, you know, even in the US, if you look at, you know, there was three sort of eras, I think the 20s and then the 80s they become. Why do you think they are a popular breed? What, tell me a bit about them. What is their temperament?
I think that the Chows are quite a popular dog because they don't love everybody. They love their owners, they love their family, and they really couldn't give a hoot about anybody else. They love their breeder. They always remember their breeder, which is quite a giggle. So they're very cat-like in their character. And so you sort of find, you know, people that think they'd like a cat, but they think they want like a dog. Well, they end up with a chow. You know, they're a nice protective breed without going and eating people's arms off, which is nice. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's that you know, they're not like a beagle or a Labrador. No offense to them, I love beagles and Labradors too, but they don't go running up and love everybody. They're very loyal and very devoted to their people.
And, you know, with space these days and everyone living in apartments, are they an apartment dog?
I believe that any dog can be an apartment dog. The question is, how much work are you prepared to put into a dog to be an apartment dog? I mean, you only have to look overseas at the variety of dogs that live in apartments over there. But, yes, Chows and Shar Pei's both make great apartment dogs because they're so clean inside. Chows and Shar Pei's are two breeds. Like, people often ask me questions about, you know, toilet training, and I say, well, look, I'm not that experienced at it, because by 4 weeks, the Chows and the Shar Pei's are wanting to go outside and they very rarely will mess up inside. So that's what makes them good apartment dogs. They're relatively quiet inside. The Chows, they don't like getting on your furniture and on your bed as much. There are always exceptions to the breed, you know, to the rule, I should say. But, yeah, generally they don't like climbing all over furniture and stuff like that. They like to sleep around the doors. That's one reason why they've given the name as the Temple Guardians, is because they like to sleep around the doorways. And people thought that's because they, you know, want to guard their property. But actually that's where the cool breeze is, if you can imagine. So, you know, so they like to sleep around the doorways. They don't require an excessive amount of exercise, just a nice brisk walk every now and then, but they more like just to play games and have a bit of a jump around. And they get what we call chow zoomies twice a day. All the chow people will know what I'm talking about, but they get the zoomies on twice a day where they go for little zooms around. So other than that, they're pretty low maintenance in that way. Let's not talk about how much maintenance their coat is.
It's a whole different story.
Yes, whole different story, yeah.
But Di, you mentioned before Dogs New South Wales, and for the listeners who don't know about that world, you know, what is Dogs New South Wales, and how does it link, I guess, to Pedigree, which is sort of what we're interested to find out about today as well.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, great question. So in the Pedigree world, so Pedigree being those dogs that have a traceable ancestry, in the Pedigree world, each country has a canine body that looks after them all. And in Australia, it's called the ANKC, the Australian National Kennel Council. And what the ANKC does is that's kind of a little bit like having your federal government, and then you have all your state bodies. So then with the ANKC, we have all our state bodies. And so they're all sort of, these days, they're called Dogs New South Wales, Dogs ACT, Dogs Queensland. You get the gist there. Yep. So Dogs New South Wales is our state body of the ANKC, which is the internationally recognised kennel council.
And they've got links, I guess, yeah, to the Kennel Club in Britain and to the American Kennel Council in the US. So it's sort of that they're all sort of interlinked.
Yeah. Yes. So each country sort of recognises different kennel controls and whatever in all the other countries. So
what you're saying there, Di, is that Hugh Gent is the Scott Morrison.
Yes. Okay. I hope he's not listening. Sorry, Hugh. Hugh Gent, who heads up the ANKC.
I like the way you put that. It's like having your states. I didn't put it that way. And then, of course, you've got your federal, which is the ANKC. I've never thought of it that way. But if you ask me, the states usually run
the show.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
It's almost exactly the same, you know, where you've got ScoMo on TV saying that he can't tell the states what lockdown they should be in and shouldn't be. The ANKC has the same problem where they can kind of give you a bit of a hint or whatever, but the states are the ones that make the rules for their states. There's a lot of talk these days as to whether or not it needs to be more encompassing. The problem being that that each state has to follow their own government rules and regulations too, and so it becomes a little bit messy there. But there certainly are some things that that could be a little bit more uniform between the states.
You know, maybe we could get Hugh on for one segment.
Yeah, I think that'd be
great. That would be awesome. And
talk to him about just how it all works. It might, you know, be 40 minutes of just legislation and boring conversation, but hey, you know,
he's very interesting to listen to. Yes,
and he's a Labrador lover, isn't
he's
he?
He's a Labrador lover. Yeah. Yes, he is.
I've got some really tough questions here for you, Di. These have been ones that I've been sort of sitting down. Can you tell me, is the chow tongue, is it born blue or does it become blue?
No, it becomes blue. And it's a shame, you know, the viewers can't see this, but I can run and get, I've got a young one just, no, they're born pink. And they start to black in. So the little puppies I've got here at the moment are about 10 days old and they're just starting to get little black speckles. So it's quite a funny thing, both the Chow and the Shar Pei, you know, the breeders, you know, from about day five, we're looking in that mouth. Are you blacking in? Because it's so important. What people don't understand with that, we call it pigmentations. And so that pigmentation of the tongue is that it's one of the few links that the Chinese people have with their ancient past. A lot of their ancient past was destroyed during the Han Dynasty. You know, times of hardship and that, where they just, you know, absolutely destroyed everything. And so it's a link that they have back to that ancient past. So it's our job to keep that pigment, you know, and not let it just drift off because somebody thinks it's not important.
And I guess that's part of the breed standard as well. Like, I mean, maybe not the tongue color, I don't know, but certainly all it is, it's in the breed standard.
Definitely is, yes. Ah. It's what we call one of the hallmarks. So you asked earlier about, you know, pedigree and what is pedigree and what the difference is. So I guess now's it sort of, we need to cover that off before we can talk about breed standards. So a purebred dog is a dog that's, you know, created by mating two dogs of the same breed. That's purebred. Pedigree, on the other hand, is the same thing. It's a purebred dog, but with a trackable history, like, you know who its ancestors are, you know who its parents are, its grandparents, its great-grandparents, so on and so forth. So, you know, purebreds, yes, will have the same phenotype, but your pedigrees, you know, we've got it written down there where we can trace it back.
So that pedigree is really the key. That's what that piece of paper that has currently three generations on it and shows you those three generations is really what is the ANKC stamp appears on. That is your piece of paper that says this is a pedigree ANKC dog.
Yes.
And talking about smiles, that's one of the things I love about the Chow Chow. That constant smile they have. You know, they always look like they're smiling.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. We do get a few snobs. There's,
you know,
they actually, it's funny you should say scowl, Nathan, because their breed standard does say that they have to have a scowl.
Literally resting bitch face, maybe.
Yes, I've got a few of those out there at the moment. But yeah, look, they do have a bit of a smile. They are a bit of a grinny breed. But I probably think, you know, your things like your Samoyeds and things like that are a much more smiley breed than a Chow.
Yeah. Talking about standard, can I just ask you what colours are not accepted as part of the standard?
So with the Chows, so there's only five colours. So there's red, black, blue, cream and fawn. So they're the only five colours in the Chows in Australia that you can recognise.
Are they all accepted?
Those colours are accepted, yes.
And do you get any colours outside of the standard that you're...
I haven't seen any, but overseas there are some. So there's some chocolates and somebody is trying chocolates. Chocolate, which is, you know, colour of chocolate.
Di, you know, welcome to how some of these things happen. People looking for these new and exotic colours.
Well, there's even a blue merle out there somewhere and they're claiming that they are pedigree. So
where's that merle come from?
Don't know. You know genetics, who knows?
It just must have popped out of the sky, Di.
That's where it's come from.
One day,
somewhere.
You're born and this merle came about.
There was no crossing. There was no mixing,
what
nothing.
What are you talking about, Di? Crossing.
That doesn't happen.
And I guess, I mean, colour is just one part of a breed standard. Is that's right? So what are the other elements of a breed standard that you're looking for, you know, in the Chow or the Shar Pei?
Yeah, so what a breed standard is. So we spoke about the ANKC. So the ANKC recognises breeds, and when a breed has been recognised, and that means that it's, you know, being signed off as, yes, you are a breed, they have a breed standard. So what a breed standard is like a recipe, I guess. It's a description of the dog. So it's physical description, you know, how it looks, how long its coat is, what colour it is, you know, what its eyes look like, everything. It also describes their temperament, and it also describes how the dog moves. But the very first part of the standard talks about the history of the breed. And this is something that people sort of don't think about, but a judge, so I'll talk about judges training later, but a judge looking at a dog needs to understand what it was bred for and in what context, so that it can understand then how the dog should look and how it should move and what its temperament should be. You know, if a dog was bred to be a nanny dog, it should be a nice, quiet, gentle, you know,
That's why when you go to a show, they make you run up and diagonally and across. Yeah. And it's not for you to show how good you run. It's so they can see this dog in
movement. See the gait, see the movement.
Yeah, hopefully they're not looking at me. So they're the three things that a judge is looking at. They're looking at the physical attributes of the dog that it meets the standard. So it looks like what that breed is supposed to look like. It has the temperament that it's supposed to have, and it moves how it should move. So they're the three, you know, key things that the judge is looking at.
And Di, can the standard in Australia vary to the standard in the US?
Definitely. Okay. So you generally have your standard comes from the origin of the breed or where the breed was first recognised. So if the Chow, for example, that's a good example. Even though its origin is China, the first place the breed standard was written was England. And so we go off the English standard with a, you know, few minor alterations, but the standard generally comes from the country of origin of where it was first recognised.
So in general, there's an ANKC standard, there's an AKC standard, and there's an FCI standard.
FCI
is that right?
Standard, yes, okay. Yes. And I can't even say the word that FCI stands for.
What is that? That's the European.
It's sort of the big overarching one. The FCI is considered the pinnacle of
the correct.
Yeah, everybody sort of answers to them, basically. So they're the big international one.
Like the UN of the dog world.
Yes, exactly.
So another question I've got for you, Di, has there been a Chow Chow that's won a national or a show, a royal show, a Chow Chow that's won a Chow?
No, we've gone very close. Very
you know,
very
judges close. Judges just don't understand the breed, Di. That's the problem, you know.
There's so many good dogs out there. There's been one in particular that's gone close. But no, we haven't won a royal yet, but we've got that in our sights.
Yeah. Not even the Canberra Royal?
Not even the Canberra Royal. So my big boy won Best Intermediate in Show at the Canberra Royal, not last year, but the year before. So, you know, they're knocking on the door, but you know, those poodles and those Dobermans and those Akitas and those Siberians. Oh, dear. Anyway, we'll get there. Yeah.
And how many ANKC registered Chow Chow breeders do we have?
In Australia? Oh, that's a great question, George. I don't know. Off the top of my head, if I sort of have a quick whip around of the ones that I know, there'd probably be, I'd be surprised if there was more than 50.
Okay. Yeah, only that low. Interesting.
Yeah, there's
look, you know, when I remember when I went to you to the seminar you held, there were young and there were old breeders when I was there. So you've got a nice range.
Yeah. A generational movement.
So that's a positive.
Yeah, that sort of when I first came into the breed, there sort of wasn't a big uptake on new breeders. Like most of the breeders that I met had been breeding for quite some time. And then we've had a little bit of a resurgence more recently, and a few of the sort of more experienced breeders have taken a lot of people, you know, under their wing and mentored them really well. So we've got a couple of new breeders coming through, which is really good to see. Really good.
I guess that's sort of the importance of pedigree breeding, I guess, sort of, you know, making sure that there's enough breeders working on the Chow Chow and continuing the lineage, because ultimately, like that, you know, I know you also talk about being a preservation breeder, and I guess that comes into it as well.
Yes, well, that's so that is the big thing. One of the reasons why we do breed and breed pedigrees, and we'll get on to talking about the whole pedigree versus crossbreed thing, I guess, in a little while. But the whole idea of breeding a pedigree dog is to preserve that breed. So we are preservation breeders. So it's similar to, you see people arc up about the Sumatran tiger versus the, you know, the North American tiger and things like that, you know, and they want to preserve that subspecies of thing. And it's the same with your dog breeds. You know, if we don't preserve these breeds, they will just die out. They'll die a very sad and lonely death that we won't have those breeds to continue on with. So that's what preservation breeding is about. And we need more people. We need to instill some passion into some other people to want to continue these breeds.
I guess then, yeah, so what's important for you in terms of pedigree breeding? You know, what do you consider to be best practice in the pedigree breeding world? How does one, you know, become a pedigree breeder and become good at it?
Yes, yeah, no, that's awesome question again. So to me, you know, best practice in being, you know, somebody responsible for preserving a breed is to always be striving to breed the best dog that you can and breed to that standard. So it's not just a case of I'm going to breed Mitzi with Fido. It's like, you know, if I breed this dog to this dog, you know, what am I going to get phenotypically and temperamentally? And, you know, is it healthy? You know, always undertaking your relevant health tests for that breed. And every breed will have, you know, a different list. Some of them have a list as long as your arm. Some of them don't even have a list.
And good news, the Chow Chow has a very small list.
Has a very short list. Yes. When it comes to stuff that can be tested through DNA, and that's the thing people don't understand too, isn't it, George, not everything can be tested through DNA. No. So we have a couple of things with DNA, but we also
there's
have
a lot
some
you
physical.
If I could test for hips and elbows and luxating patellas, I'd retire.
And we'd all be going ahead a lot quicker.
It's, you know, I think you raise an interesting thing. I'm not a breeder, but one thing I do see is that getting yourself to a dog that is temperament, really, you know, the right temperament and phenotype, and it takes time. Mm-hmm. It's not just one or two generation breeding. If you look at most, you've got to be in it for a long time. It's about picking a particular dam to sire, getting that. It takes time. You might have to sometimes import semen in to help you improve your lines. And unfortunately, and I don't mean this in a negative, the younger generation want things a bit quicker and think I can get to that, you know, that standard fairly quickly. It doesn't. It doesn't happen.
It's like a lifetime pursuit.
It is. And sort of going back to that that question of, you know, what best practice is. So apart from doing all that, where you're selecting the right dogs to breed, you know, that they represent the breed well, that they're sound with their temperament, that they're sound with their health, you also need to continue your education. I find so many breeders, so the ANCASI, the state bodies, all have a breeder education scheme. So if anybody wants to become a breeder, they go through this breeder education scheme where they learn a little bit about genetics and about, you know, breeding and cycles and all those sorts of things, you know, handling your bitch, handling your dog, all those things. But once that's done and dusted, there's no further education at the moment, and it's up to us to sort of educate ourselves. And I find that in general, the sort of the breeding fraternity within the ANKC are very forthgoing with the sharing of their knowledge, and you need to be prepared to share your knowledge. You need to be prepared to listen to other people and to change your mind too. You know, things that we used to do even 3 years ago, we don't do now. You know, we find new stuff and new science. I always love things backed up by science. Mm. Anecdotal evidence is great, but science is really good.
Yep. So do you have things like, I mean, breed ambassadors, like if someone's starting, someone who then is able to
not formally, George. We do encourage people to find themselves a mentor, and generally people so obviously to become a breeder you need to have a bitch to breed with, and so generally the breeder of that bitch will mentor that person, or whoever's dog they're using, you know, will mentor that person. But it's very important to have a mentor.
And maybe that's another podcast episode, because I do get a lot of questions about how do I start?
Where do you begin?
You said, find a bitch. You know how it is sometimes to find a breeding bitch? How it is to actually get someone to give you an animal to go ahead and breed with? Because in the end, I hate this word, but it is competition. You know, in the end, so in many cases, it's very difficult for someone to actually get a start.
Look, it is. And I think one of the problems is that people don't understand that competition is good and competition is healthy, and you need competition. Bring it on. Because, I mean, think of your Ford versus Holden. I mean, I'm a mad Holden fan, you know, and Fords aren't even allowed to park in my driveway. And I love Bathurst every year. And people think, what does that do for you? And I said, well, it actually gave technology in my current vehicle. You know, it filters down. And the same in the dog world, you know, that the competition, you know, and us, you know, trying to beat the other guy and
the Brock versus Johnson was just, you just died with him. I mean, then you had Moffat with his Cobras, you know, made them change cars and look for different ways to
gosh, remember that, and the 1-2s yell at them, no.
That could be a good session, because it's always a question I get, you know, people want to start.
Where do you start? No. Yes. And we need people to do that. I mean, but you know what, George, on the other hand, I'm falling over myself trying to find people to take on shows of prospects. Yeah. I've got, you can't see them behind me, but I've got five lovely little boys there, and I'm sure that more than one of them is going to be, you know, ready for the show ring, but I can't find
them. And so you've got a nice boutique breed. I'm sort of talking more in the, you know, sometimes the problem I have too is that some people that do start get a dog and the dog's absolute, I'm sorry to say it, crap.
They've
managed to get access to a breeding animal, and all of a sudden they find that it's got all these issues and temperament-wise, unfortunately that's the only dog they could start with. So, again, an interesting topic, because it sort of creates a lot of discussion, and you want young people to sort of, you know, take on some of this breeding, and it's difficult for them because getting started is not.
And that's why I know for at least New South Wales, to become a breeder, then you needed to have titled at least one dog. And what that proves to them is that you've gone out there, you've gone to shows, you've got, you know, a bit of an understanding of what, you know, what it's all about, and, you know, what your dog's like. And that's the whole idea behind that.
Because it's not a God-given right either. You know, you need to be getting into it for the right reasons, and you know, it probably should still be a bit difficult in some ways to be able to become a breeder, because you've got to be doing it for the welfare of the dog and you know, making sure that's always like front of mind.
Well, I mean, that's it. You know, it's not just about, you know, that I've got a dog and I want to breed it. You have to have the right reasons to breed it. You know, so. Yeah, which brings us into that polarizing questions of, you know, why do we breed non-pedigree dogs, and should you know, what should happen? Should non-pedigree dogs be bred?
I'm very curious, Di, on your opinion on this, because obviously it's something that's, you know, in the last probably couple of decades that's sort of become more prominent. Even in the last year, we've seen it with COVID as well, the sort of rise of the oodle breeds. And curious, you know, what do you see as the place of non-pedigree in all of this?
I guess, first of all, we need to just, you know, understand why it is that it is so polarizing, why we get your passionate pedigree people that you know, just will not have anything to do with non-pedigree, let alone crossbreeds, but non-pedigree purebreds and that. And that is because of the time and the energy that they've put into to preserving that breed, you know, and they often believe that the non-pedigrees and the crossbreeds and that are ruining and destroying those breeds. So you have to understand that passion and that commitment they've had. And some of these have been in generations of their family. So that passion is really there. And then, you know, it's also that whole concept of, are these people actually committed to the welfare of the dogs? You know, not just the welfare and the preservation of the breed, but the actual, you know, right there, right now, the welfare of those dogs and the welfare of the puppies. So An ANKC registered breeder is committed by our code of ethics to continue supporting families and puppies for, you know, years and years to come, for the whole of their life. You know, at any time a pedigree breeder will take their dog back if it doesn't work out for whatever reason. You know, and there's that belief that the non-pedigree people, once they get the dollars in the hand, that puppy moves on and that's no more a part of their life. And I've seen that. I've witnessed that firsthand. I do a lot of rescue work and I take in a lot of, I do specific chows and Shar Pei's. And the first thing I always say when one comes up for offer is, have you gone back to the breeder? And they won't, they're not interested. So
I hear you. And yeah. Nathan, I think if we're looking for the next ANKC president, dies it.
Yeah. You know, she's literally
covered.
No.
Oh,
she's
literally
got my vote.
That, yeah. Well, my vote. Spoken good like a true. Oh, die. No, I think that's your campaign.
These are not all just my ideas. This is from getting to shows, getting to trials, getting out there with dog people and listening to them. This is what they're
you
saying.
Haven't got, you yeah. haven't, you haven't got that purple pink hair. Over the years for nothing. It's
good on you.
It's a part of the, your wisdom's in that purple.
Yeah.
But you're so right, though. Yeah, it's that empathy is really important.
Yeah, well, that's it. The other things that you have to think too with this whole polarizing is that there's outdated reasons for breeding. There's people out there, and we call these the mum and dad breeders, people out there that they've got themselves, Mitzi from their mate down the road whose dog accidentally had pups and whatever. And wouldn't it be lovely for Mitzi to have pups? You know, she should have pups. And it's like these old wives' tale that it settles them down and whatever else. It couldn't be any further from the truth. They're not like humans. They don't crave having children. It's just a natural instinct. They come in season, they mate, they have pups, they go, what are these? They look after them, they leave them, they don't care. You know, it's like they move on. When's my next meal coming from? That's what they think about. So those outdated reasons for breeding, you know, is one of those things. And the good old puppy mills. This is probably one of the biggest things that your pedigree breeders are up against. Are the commercial breeders. So the people that are out there, you know, churning out puppies, and that's a whole nother podcast.
That's another part. But there is more and more regulation now coming in to try and manage that. I see now that, you know, state governments are putting in bin numbers and making sure that, you know, people are identifying via...
There's more transparency.
There's more. It is. I think governments are starting to realise it as well and try and regulate those backyard breeders. I service quite a number of breeding facilities and I can tell you their setups are quality.
Yeah.
Quality.
And yes. And so this is why I said it's so polarizing, because I personally, and I'm going out on a limb here, but I personally don't have a problem with puppy farmers, with the puppy mills, if they're done right. I look at some of those setups myself, and some of those dogs are looked after much better than some of the pedigree, ANKC breeders I've seen with their setups. Some people have got magnificent setups.
I've seen some of them, and they are quality. And you know, they've got to go through a really tough process to actually get accredited and be issued with their permit for as a breeding facility. So.
Yes. Yeah, I don't see it any different. You know, our problem is that the dog is so close to us and we're so passionate about dogs, yet we're quite happy for all the cows in the paddocks to be bred commercially. You know, there's some countries that love cows and are mortified at the way we breed them. We can, and a whole nother podcast. But I think you're right, George, in that our problem with ANKC is that we are not recognised as the peak body ownership. You know, if you ask Joe Blow down the street, where are you going to look for your next puppy?
And they won't know.
Gumtree, you know, I'll look on Gumtree. I'll put it in my search engine and see where it takes me. Yeah. Hopefully they go to Rightpool.
You know, be able to work with, you know, as soon as something comes out about, you know, companion animals, the ANKC should be the spokespeople, the first people that is, and somehow you just don't do that well. Now, you know, whether it's because it's each run by each state or whatever, it's just, you know, we could talk about this when we get Hugh on, and I'm sure Hugh will have answers and explain why, but...
Yeah. I think it goes back as well to, you know, what's the motivation of the breeder behind breeding as well? Are they doing it for the welfare of the dogs? Are they doing it to better the breed and to to produce, I guess, you know, yeah, a companion animal that's going to go to a loving home.
Yeah, exactly. You know, why are they breeding? And you know what? I think there's room for both. We cannot, the number of pedigree breeders we have in Australia and the number of pedigree pups we're pumping out, we cannot hope to meet the demand for puppies out there.
Yes, puppies, correct.
Cannot hope to meet it. No. So, I don't see why we shouldn't, you know, take steps towards actually bringing these other breeders into our fold.
Thank you. You hit the nail. Di, I mean, you need to stand for AKC.
There's a gold mine we're missing. Apart from the money we could make.
This is what I argued from day one.
Yes.
They were taken away and dismissed when you should have actually bought them in
and
accepted them as part of, you know, everyone, they all love dogs. It's loving a dog.
Yes,
it's the same.
I mean, the same thing happened. A lot of people forget where their breed came from in the first place. I can stand up and say my two are ancient and there's very little crossing went on.
That's right.
The Boston Terrier, the Bulldog, the Dalmatian, they're all created from other dogs. You know, they all started somewhere where someone thought, you know what, I don't like the size and the shape of that and I want to change it a little and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then they cemented it.
We're talking 100 years of breed development there, compared to, I know the word is the Labradoodle, which is only sort of a 20-year breed. Yeah. So who knows in 80 years' time when we're not, it might actually be a defined breed and have a defined and
that's
an accepted
right.
breed.
Yeah. And dogs were bred for a specific purpose back then because, you know, we used dogs a lot more.
That's right.
You know, we needed them for, you know, many and very different things. Whereas these days we don't need those dogs to perform those duties anymore. But you know what? We've got new duties now. We've got service dogs.
Yeah, therapy dogs.
Therapy dogs. You know, dogs are going to sit around in the kids' classroom and read books with them and whatever. Mm. So, there's different breeds might be developed for that.
And this is something at Ridepool that we really believe as well. You know, we've been striving to create a really inclusive platform that doesn't discriminate between pedigree, non-pedigree, purebred, crossbreed. It's just about how do we ultimately, you know, create that inclusive environment, because responsibility is something that we believe can exist across all breeders, regardless of the breed that they're breeding.
That's right. And you know what? Some of these crossbreeders or non-pedigree purebred breeders are a wealth of knowledge, you know, and we can share our knowledge with them and get knowledge from them.
Yeah, it's all for the betterment of the dogs. And we'd love to have some of them on the podcast as well. I think we've had some great reception from a few breeders that said, I'd love to come on and share that. Just that knowledge exchange is so important.
So, yes. Di, keeping up with my really tough questions
on
the Chow Chow.
Yeah.
Is it true
that
the first teddy bear was actually modelled on the Chow Chow? This is what I've heard.
It's definitely true. So you may hear when I'm at a show and the kids come up and they're a little bit intimidated by the big chow, and you'll always hear me say, come and pat my big teddy bear. And they look at them and they say, I never grew up and I never grew out of teddy bears. I just got a real one. And they love it. They're the original teddy bear.
Teddy bear, that's what I thought. Yeah. And people like Janet Jackson have owned one.
There's been a few. Freud,
one of the greatest neurologists and founder of psychoanalysis.
Yeah, he's my most favourite chow.
Should we be reading into that? What's the Freudian meaning behind
There's
that?
There's also intelligent women that own Martha Stewart.
Martha Stewart, yes. She loves the chows. Yeah, definitely. There's a whole riff of them, and I'm very bad at remembering the names.
Another thing I've also done, I've done a lot of Chow Chow research, as you can see.
Nice.
And I've gone to your boot camps, and I haven't seen the Chow Chow relish.
Oh, Chow, it's coming.
Do you know that there is one?
A relish?
There's a Chow Chow relish.
Right.
Yeah, look it up. You can make one. It's got peppers in it. Onion, tomato. It's called the Southern Chow Chow Relish.
I feel a new prize coming on.
I
think we'll be giving out relish. Yeah, I remember touring New Zealand at one stage and went past a restaurant, one Asian restaurant, can't remember what sort, and looked on the menu and there was Chow Chow.
So I know what you're thinking.
Oh, my God.
What possessed me to Google Chow Chow recipe?
Yes, what but did, I did possess you?
I thought
it's a whole different. Well, Di said that the pedigree breed standard was a recipe. You just took it a bit too literally.
Too far.
And I found one, so maybe, you know, we could put it up, but I looked at it and maybe I think maybe at the next boot camp you can get people to make a chow and I'll come and taste the chow chow relish.
It's a bit of blue tongue, a dash of scowl, it all makes the chat.
Yes, and his stilted gait, the only breed to have a stilted gait.
But Di, I think it's been amazing to have you on the podcast and to hear also from a pedigree breeder and a purebred breeder who's, you know, has a very modern take on the dog world and who's very, you know, forward thinking and progressive and sees the role of all of these associations and breeds. And, you know, if you could leave our listeners, you know, with one piece of advice, whether they be, you know, breeders or owners, you know, what's something that you'd love, you know, a message you'd love to put in a billboard for all dog owners to see?
Be responsible. So be responsible, and that, because that encompasses so much, you know, being responsible for the dog you have right there, right now, but being responsible for the breed moving forward, being responsible for canines in general moving forward. So we just need to be a little bit more responsible. That's my single word message. Well, two words, be responsible. Yeah.
Now, Di, on every episode, we have a segment that allows George to bloom and blossom. And it's basically, I have a disease book here and I ask Nathan to always pick a number between one and 200 odd. And I read out the disease. It's a bit of education, you know.
Nice.
And it could be a disease that's via a genetic test. And as you're aware, there are many, many hereditary diseases that you can't test for genetically. So yes. Let's give this a go. And I think what we can do, Nathan, is we can let Di pick a number.
I think it's only fair.
Yeah, it's only, you know, drum roll. Okay.
Drum roll. Let's go with my age, 59. I know I don't look it, but 59.
I thought you were going to say 21.
Good. And you know what? We haven't picked that number, which was great.
Which is great. 59.
Ooh. So you've picked 59 and we've gone to the letter E, and it's exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. In brackets, EPI.
EPI.
The breeds that we tend to see this in, so again, good news, it's not a genetic test, bugger.
Oh,
Is the German Shepherd, the Collie Rough and Smooth, the Beagle, the English Setter. The Chow Chow is listed.
There you go.
I am not, have a look at this. I'm not making this up, Di.
No.
Scary. This is scary. Here we were thinking the Chow Chow was the healthiest breed, and you've picked exocrine pancreatic insufficiency.
Inability to produce sufficient pancreatic enzymes.
Okay, well, I've got it here. It's a book here, and I think
it's in your book.
It's an ELISA test you can currently do for fecal pancreatic elastase. This is why elastase 1 in dogs is available and marketed as a screening tool for EPI. So you can get it from a veterinarian. It's an ELISA test. It's a progressive condition that results in the ability to properly digest foods, causing weight loss and abnormal feces, loose and pale.
Mm.
Animals having quite a ravenous appetite.
Wow.
What are some of the, let's have a look. So symptoms are that patients will obviously vomit, display picker and copper. I hate these words that are always, my son tells me, Dad, you should be able to pronounce these. Half of these are Latin and Greek origin, but I can't even get those right. Between Nathan and myself, the Italian and the Greek, we should be
able. At least I need to see it in front of me. I could give it a red hot crack.
You need to be able to say nomenclature
That's right. Picker is eating substance. If it's affected animals can literally waste away from malnutrition.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Even though they're still eating lots. It's one of those things. Yeah.
And you haven't seen this in your breeding program to date, I'm guessing.
No, haven't seen it.
Well, you know, it should be Chow Chows, not ANKC. Treatment is with pancreatic enzymes that are added to the food.
Mm-hmm.
And affected animals generally respond very well, depending on the type and quality of the product used.
Mm.
That's great.
Interesting. Supplement vitamin B12 is often required. Di, once again, that's another number we've gone through in this book, and hopefully when we get to the 200th episode, this book will be over, Nate.
Yeah, we'll need something else. If we get to 200 episodes, then we'll write another book together.
Yeah, no, that's cool.
Amazing. Well, Di, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic.
A shame we sort of didn't get to everything that I'd love to talk about, but you know that
it'll get to another segment, Di.
we'll
this is what happens. You came on for a 40-minute chat.
Yeah.
And we literally went on and on off topic and back on topic and then gave us your ANKC running for president. Yeah.
So this was your campaign launch, is that right?
I've got other missions that I want to complete besides being an ANKC president.
We'll have to have you back on for part two.
Yeah. Excellent. That'd be awesome.
Like always, lovely to have you on. You're always a lovely person to chat.
Thanks, George.
Always smiling, always got positive things to do, and you've always helped whenever you can. You're one of our collection agents as well, and we're the first to put your hand up to help other breeders where you can. So, you know,
thanks,
gold
George.
Star.
No, thanks. No, it's all good fun. And thanks, Nathan, for having us and for all that Rightpaw do for us.
Pleasure. No, it's great to be partnered with such fantastic breeders and partners in the health world as well. So, no, thanks again. And to all our listeners, we'll speak to you next week.